My name is Shirley Stashko, and I am here with Ted Turkowski at his beautiful place here in Pleasant Valley Lodge in Athabasca. Today is March the 9th. Ted, could you please give us your father's name?
My father's name is Dimitro Turkowski.
And your mother's name?
I wonder if should I spell that.
Sure.
Dimitro, spelled D-M-Y-T-R-O. And my mother's name is Annie Pawliuk. Last name spelled P-A-W-L-I-U-K.
Okay, and when were you born?
I was born on May 14th, 1936.
And where?
On the farm in the New Pine Creek District in the Athabasca Municipality.
And what is your spouse's name?
My spouse's maiden name, Dorothy Stotesbury. Stotesbury spelled S-T-O-T-E-S. That is Stotesbury.
Good, thank you. Now, Ted, you've prepared your story, and I'll just let you take over at this point.
Okay. My father, Dimitro Turkowski, was born on October 2nd, 1903. In the Jaworo district of Poland, which is now in the Ukraine, and spelled and pronounced Jaworiv. In the English alphabet, you would spell Jaworiv, Y-A-V, V like in Victor, Y-A-V-O-R-I-V. In the village of Gnojnice, Poland. And that Gnojnice is spelled G-N-O-J-N-I-E-C-E. That was in Poland. In a peace treaty by the League of Nations in 1921, Poland lost this region to the Ukraine. And that's why we have the two different spellings for Jaworo and Jaworiv. And the village is now, I see on my iPad, Googled, the village is not Gnojnice anymore, it's Lynette, which is spelled H-L-Y-N-E-T-S. Dad was orphaned in his early teens and grew up in Gnojnice. Father served in the Polish army for a few years. After discharge from the army, he went to work in the coal mines of southern France. There he learned to speak French. Later, here in the Athabasca area, I remember him joking back and forth with our farm neighbors of French descent, and there was much laughter. I never understood what was being said. Father Dimitro came to Canada and Alberta in 1929 at the age of 26 years and went to work as a farm laborer on farms in the Daisland area, southeast of Edmonton. After about a couple of years of this work, he went to work sporadically on track maintenance for the railroad company when there was an opening. Dear listener to this story, to get a clearer picture of the severity of those years, please realize that when Dad arrived in Canada, as did many others, he entered into the teeth of what is now remembered as the Great Depression. The period of roughly 10 years of economic collapse, when large companies down to small farmers were going bankrupt, with scarce gainful employment, hunger, and resultant misery. Farm commodity prices dropped to next to nothing. I remember that when, in my youth, I'd ask older neighbors about who owns certain quarter sections of abandoned land that had fields cleared of forest. The answer was, it's owned by Credit Foncier. I suspect they were a lending institution, a bank or lending firm. From my perspective, coupled with severe drought leading to crop failures, borrowing too much more money than productivity could make payments on in lean times, by large companies and individuals, mainly caused the Great Depression. Through my working years and into my retirement, I, with others, have often worried that history will be repeated. Will this or future generations be able to cope as well as they did in 1929 to 39? The danger lies in violent rebellion instead. In those years, Dad struggled to learn the English language, which, with its system of weights and measures, the European metric system, he knew, was useless here. Though he could speak Ukrainian, Polish, and French, and read and write Polish and Ukrainian, Ukrainian Polish alphabets, by the way, are different. He learned English with considerable mutilation. In my youth, when I listened in, I observed that the men of different ethnic backgrounds with much better English somehow understood Dad's words in spite of the mutilation. My mother, Annie Turkowski, was born on a farm 12 miles south of Holden, Alberta. Holden is spelled H-O-L-D-E-N, to Catherine Ni Matkowski and Paul Pavlyuk. In April of 1917, mother Annie Turkowski, at the age of 5, and her brother Frank, aged 4 years, lost their mother to childbirth and their father to an accident while repairing a wagon wheel. 11 months later. So orphans Annie and Frank were taken in and raised by their grandparents, Joseph and Mary Matkowski, who lived in the Kopernik district, as did Catherine and Paul Pavlyuk. Kopernik is roughly south of Holden. Joseph Matkowski was about 62 years old when his wife Mary and he adopted the granddaughter, my mother, and her brother Frank. In 1932, the Matkowski family moved from the Holden area to the New Pine Creek district, 20 miles southeast of Athabasca, Alberta. Here, under the Homestead Act, they acquired 4 quarter sections of forested land, a quarter section each, in the names of Joseph, Mary, and their sons, Ed and John. I often heard the story of them sleeping under large spruce trees while building their cabin, which they roofed with cedar shingles. Those shingles served from 1932 till 1957, 25 years. Eventually, they also built a log barn, a long log granary, log hog house, blacksmith shop with forge, and chicken coop, all from the farm's trees, both aspen and spruce. I expect that when they were making a clearing for the yard, the trees were right there. This work was done on the northeast quarter of Section 32, Township 63, Range 21, west of the 4th Meridian. They also cleared and put under cultivation 15 acres of land mandated by the government to gain title to the quarter section. This land was registered in Mary Mutkowski's name. Mother, I like to say orphan Annie, when her family lived in the Houghton area, was able to go to school only occasionally because she had to help with the chores at home. As a consequence, she completed only grade 2. In spite of this, her handwriting was perfect in English, and she had no trouble subtracting, multiplying, and dividing numbers. She spoke Ukrainian, Polish, and good English. My father, Dmytro Trakowski, and mother, Annie Pollock, or they pronounced it Pauliuk before, were married on December 2nd, 1934, in Edmonton, at the Holy Rosary Catholic Church. Dmytro and Annie's introduction and marriage were arranged by Annie's grandmother. After Dmytro and Annie's marriage, Annie's grandmother, Mary Mutkowski, signed the farm over to her granddaughter. This was the farm with its buildings and around 20 acres of cleared land on the quarter section. Dmytro, my father, bought three horses, two cows, one heifer, and the small farming implements of that time from the Mutkowskis. There's a copy of the bill of sale dated November 27, 1934, in the New Pine Creek History Book. Shortly after this, the Mutkowskis sold off or abandoned the remaining lands, which were another three quarters, and moved away from the New Pine Creek District and the Athabasca region. Now the rest of this is going to be I. I, Ted Trakowski, baptized Theodore Trakowski, was born in our little log cabin on the bank of Pine Creek to Annie and Dmytro Trakowski on May 14, 1936. Our close neighbor, Mrs. Emil Michalak, was in attendance as a midwife. I was the firstborn of 10 surviving siblings, almost all born at home in the same original cabin on the northeast quarter of Section 32, Range 21, Township 63, west of the 4th Meridian. I don't know if I should even say this, but I will anyway. I find the telling of this story very laborious and time-consuming. I will not tell the story of my 9 dear siblings. Being obsessed with accuracy of details like dates, place names, distances, and so forth, I check, double-check, and sometimes triple-check, then write things all over again. So, also, we have written our stories in the books titled Colinton and Districts, Yesterday and Today, and the book Sharing the Past of the New Pine Creek District. In this story, I will review the history of my maternal great-grandparents because they were the pioneers of the land on which I was born. Also my parents. Next, I will bore the listener with some details from my life. Not intending to bore, but someday somebody might be interested. In the summertime, or this is going to be memories before school, in the summertime I went barefoot most of the time before starting school. I wore a sort of cross between the shirt and the dress that mother made from the flour and sugar sacks. Sometimes on my feet, I wore the low slip-on rubbers that mother would buy at the New Pine Creek store, 2.5 miles away from home. I do remember how proud and happy I was of their new black shine. Wearing them, walking home from the store, I'd look back whenever we crossed a patch of dusty road and admire the design of the pattern they made in the dust. Those little rubbers. These had to do through spring, summer, and part of autumn. I also remember every year they were one size larger. I found it easy to walk barefoot in a wild hay stubble that had been cut by Dad with a scythe. Though the skin on the soles of my feet was hardened, walking in grain stubble was painful. In the winter, I wore what was called felt socks. These were calf high, about 3/8 thick felt, and slipped on like a rubber boot over wool socks, knitted by mother. The felt socks had the low black rubbers, a size or two larger, pulled over them to keep the felt from getting wet in the snow. The rubbers were a nuisance because they'd freeze solid and slip off the socks when we walked. Sometimes we'd slip the rubber rings used on canning jars over the foot rubbers to help keep them on. Believe it or not, I still remember the frustration I felt because I couldn't stop my baby, at that time brother Mike's, crying. Mike, 2 years younger than me, was about 1 year old and I would have been 3. I was often left to babysit as Mom and Dad were away at some field work. I knew if I needed them, I'd never be able to find them. Mike was in a rocking cradle, which I rocked and rocked, sometimes dipping his soother in sugar to stop his crying. I became tired, and he was still crying. I was worried, so I climbed into the cradle and rocked it from the inside. Mother often said that when she and Dad got home, they found both Mike and me asleep in the cradle. And I, you know, believe it or not, I do remember that time. Because, well, of course, I heard that story.
How old were you?
3 years old. The first years of my life, till 7 years of age, were spent learning how to look after my younger brother Mike and sisters, Victoria and Evangeline, while mother and father worked in the fields or occasionally went for an evening visit to the neighbors. So I'd be left with the kids. Some of the other chores. I would wash and dry dishes, gather eggs from the chicken coop and different places in the bush where the chickens lay, and carry firewood into the wood box in the house. We had a dog named Ginger that I was very fond of. On a couple of occasions, that dog picked up a stick of firewood from the woodpile, and without being trained to do so, he carried the stick and laid it by the cabin's entrance door. And this was we'd find the stick there later. The first time we wondered, how did it get there? And then one time saw him doing it. Sometimes when Mother was busy in the kitchen, she would ask me to bring in water from the well.
How old were you?
Oh, it's sometime before school.
Before you
went
to school?
5, 6, yeah. I would draw this up with a pail permanently tied to about 16 feet of rope, dump it into the house pails and carry them into the house. In those days, Mother had her 1 acre, at least 1 acre, garden on a fertile flat of land next to the creek. I would help her carry water from the creek as she watered the garden. I remember Brother Mike, at about 2 years of age, he was 2, I'd have been 4, falling into the creek. I can still see the back of his head somehow landed in the back of his neck on some willows that had fallen across the creek, so his face was out of the water. Wisely, he just lay there without any more struggling. And Mother, she didn't realize at the time, without struggling as if he was in the bathtub, afraid that he was drowning and the water too deep for me, I shouted for Mother on the garden. She came running and fished Mike out. That's one more little memory. In those early homesteading days, a lot of the fencing was done with wooden rails cut from the bush next to the fence. I would help Father by holding rails on the ground to keep them from rolling as he notched them with the axe to fit the posts. These rails were a minimum of 25 feet long, and I would hold up the thin end while he held up and spiked the thick end. Then after spiking the thick end, I'd still be holding up the far thin end. He'd notch for the middle post in the middle of the rail, and then spike that to the post and so on and back to the third post. When I was 6 years old, there were fences only around the few acres of cultivated land where father grew grain, plus three sides of the home quarter. The south end of the home quarter was open, and the cattle had free access to about 375 acres of open, unfenced, undeeded pasture. By open, I mean there wasn't fenced. It certainly was not open. There was not bare of trees. So the cattle had access to about 375 acres of that land with undeeded pasture. This was forested with burned over patches and a large piece of boggy peatland overgrown with black spruce, tamarack, and willows. Of course, the grass and the herbs were all native. The parents kept about 6 milk cows, a couple of steers, heifers. When a cow needed to be bred, Dad would lead her to one or another of the neighbors who kept the bull. At an early age, I got acquainted well with the patches of that wild land, first by accompanying Mother when she went blueberry or strawberry picking, then later when she went searching for the cows to chase them home for the 6 o'clock milking. By 7 years of age, it was my job to find the cows and chase them home. At least two of the cows always had bells on them. You know, there's another thing, neighbors had bells too, but we learned to recognize the difference between the sound of our bells and the neighbors. Sometimes I'd cover miles in the bush and couldn't find them. I'd often stop and listen for the sound of their bells, hearing nothing but the neighbors' bells in the distance. When the cows were lying down, their bells wouldn't ring. I'd finally come home all tired out with no cows. Then I'd have to go back with Mother till we found them. On those days, milking and supper was very late. There were a few times in my search for the cows when they came home alone by a different route while I was looking for them, the wind blowing the sound of their bells away from me. Though I was tired, I was surprised and happy too when I got home to see the cows there. I started school at 7 years of age with Roy Fedorchuk and Gerald Lee, who knew the English language. Actually, Gerald did, but Roy didn't. And Gerald became my buddy. Roy and I knew only Ukrainian. Our teacher, Miss Laura Scott at Hallcroft School, started Roy and me off by pointing to various items during classes and carefully and slowly pronouncing rubbers, coat, blackboard, chalk, so forth, which we had to repeat after her. This is the way we started to learn English. The first and most important sentence we had to learn during class was to hold up our hand until teacher called our name, then say, "May I leave the room?" This was for when we urgently needed to go to the outhouse. The whole class of boys and girls, grades 1 to grade 9, would hear our request in the quiet study period. This was embarrassing, but better than the alternative of not going to the outhouse. We soon got used to it. Other than not having the English language, I did not find grade 1 at 7 years of age difficult. Mother had taught me the English alphabet and the sound of its letters and the approximate sounds of its combination of letters at home. The walk to Hallcroft School was a little more than 3 miles by road, less than that on shortcut paths that I and close neighbor families had tramped out through the bush.
Can I just interrupt?
Sure.
The name of the school is Hallcroft?
Hallcroft. Hallcroft.
Thank you.
Most of the time, I would meet with the older kids of the Mikaluk and Ronco families, a quarter mile away from our place, and we would walk to school together. One winter day, tramping home from school in the deep snow with Annie Ronco, I was feeling unwell and very tired. Annie, about 7 years older than me, picked me up and carried me piggyback through the snow the remaining 1.5 miles home. I was then and always will be grateful to Annie, who later became a registered nurse in Edmonton's Misericordia Hospital. My first year in school, there were three neighbor Ronco sisters walking the same path.
Can you spell that last name?
W-R-O-N-K-O. Ronco, yeah. It's a W-R. Kind of hard to say Ronco. You want to say W-O-R, but It's W-R. Mostly I walked with Andrew Mikaluk, who was 4 years older than me and was my best friend for the rest of his life. He passed away in December of 1989 from cancer at the age of 57 years. When we were kids, 4 years of age difference seemed like a lot, and he seemed so wise, so I was happy to follow him, even though the roads weren't always very good, but he took memories of fishing with Annette in Pine Creek, playing physically strenuous games after chores, late into the dark of night, walks to the new Pine Creek store with 15 cents in our pocket on Sundays. There were days when I would walk to school alone, when I would not meet up with the others for one reason or another. In late autumn, I remember hearing the gobbling sounds of the prairie chickens at dawn in the stooks of the wheat fields. They used to gather in flocks eating the grain. They themselves were good eating, but difficult to shoot, flying away before we get close enough for a shot. Difficult to get close enough with our .22 caliber rifles. One day going for the cows in about 1948, I started across about a 4-acre blueberry patch when a flock of prairie chickens flew up ahead of me. They flew into muskeg right next to the blueberry patch. The muskeg had swamp spruce on it. I was carrying a single-shot 12-gauge shotgun, and my family would appreciate prairie chicken for supper. Seeing that the chickens flew only a short distance for cover and would be coming back for the blueberries, I followed them into the muskeg. There was a trench in the deep moss that the cattle had tramped out as part of their path. I laid down on my stomach. Those trenches were deep. I laid down on my stomach in this trench in the moss with the shotgun in front of me, ready to shoot straight ahead, because that was the only direction I could see. And I don't think I could be seen either from the sides. I lay there what seemed a long time, but probably it was 8 minutes. Finally, I heard a whistled whee-oo sound in the muskeg some distance away and to one side of me. After about 20 seconds, there was another whee-oo on the other side of me. After 15-second pauses, these whistles came from about 5 directions from me. After a while, I, unseen and still in my trench, joined and imitated their whistle. Darned if they didn't answer. I had never heard of a human interacting with prairie chickens this way before. We continued this whistling back and forth for some time, and the chickens could be heard coming closer to me from at least 3 directions. After another long while, only one prairie chicken, about 30 feet to my left and in front of me, who had been coming closer and closer, answered my whistles. Lying in my trench motionless with a shotgun propped in front of me, my finger on the trigger, I could only see straight ahead. Now I was feeling very tense. Suddenly, on a cross path in the Muskeg, the bird darted out in front of me, and I pulled the trigger. Well, that bird, being only 15 feet in front of me, was so badly mangled by the shot that after examining it, I saw it was no use taking it home for supper. As I walked on, searching for and bringing the cows home, I had two very strong feelings. One was a feeling of pride that I'd learned to call prairie chickens. And the other feeling was of true remorse for having wasted what was probably the leader of the flock. As my whistle among the others that never moved must have made the leader think that I was one of her flock in distress, and she came to investigate. I do not remember ever having the occasion to use the call again. And I still remember, 68 years later, that call. Haven't seen such flocks of prairie chickens since about 1952. Back to my memories of Holcroft School. In the winter, I sometimes had to walk alone on the 2.5 mile path through the bush in the snow. About halfway to school, the coyotes would howl in the pitch darkness. On one side of me, maybe a quarter mile away, then another group would reply on the other side. This would go on for quite some time, and I'd keep walking with a stick. You couldn't see far in the bush and darkness. Those times I was very afraid that I would be attacked. Sometimes I'd think, maybe they're wolves. This nearby howling didn't seem to happen when we walked in a group. Now I find it hard to picture a child in their 7th and 8th year of life in those circumstances. But I suppose it was experienced by a lot of kids in the late 1940s and before. There were a lot of rabbits then, on both sides of the path and into the bush, were many sharp spears of frozen young trees that the rabbits had chewed off above the snow. The sandwiches I brought to school in my recycled lard pail were still half frozen at noon. Seemed like no problem. They were made of bought strawberry jam, peanut butter, and sometimes smeared with home rendered pig's lard, sprinkled with salt and pepper, and home baked bread always, of course. Then a homemade cookie or two. We drank water from the school as well. Being very shy, though I understood the English language eventually in my first year, I refused to attempt to speak it to my classmates for fear of being laughed at. In those times, we with Slavic names were jeered and degradingly called bohunks. To me, this was very hurtful. And from hearing conversations among the grown-ups, I knew that being called a bohunk sometimes led to fistfights among them. In view of this, I wanted my first public sentence in English to be perfect. I secretly practiced over and over. At noon lunch hour, all the boys would eat in the boys' cloakroom. The girls had a separate cloakroom. Now remember, the English-speaking classmates had never heard me utter a sentence among them, except to repeat something the teacher asked me to. As we all gathered to eat our lunch, I decided this is the day to spring my secretly practiced sentence. In a clear, loud voice I announced, "I am so hungry I could eat a rabbit." There was a moment of dead silence. Then a chorus of, "He talks! He talks!" I was very proud of the feeling of, ha, I had you buggers fooled for a long time. I still see the scene with the boys perched on a bench, a counter, and Lawrence Hutton, the eldest, and then grade 8 on the sturdy shelf above the counter, his usual place. After that, I didn't worry about my imperfect English, as it is to this day. Of course, when I was out of earshot of the others, I could speak a mixture of English and Ukrainian with the older Ukrainian neighbor's kids. The history of Hallcroft School and the Colleton and District's Yesterday and Today book, printed around 1980, under the heading Hallcroft School, has omitted 3 more teachers that taught there. They were Miss Stella Noel, Miss Laura Scott, and the other one taught in 1946. Her name I don't remember because I was going to New Pine Creek School that year. After my 1 year at Hallcroft School, because of a teacher shortage, we were transferred to Atlanta School. The walk through the bush was 2.5 miles from my home to the southwest corner of Albert and Esther Gunderson's land. There, George Knudsen, with his team of horses and Democrat, picked us, the Hallcroft pupils, up and hauled us straight north 5 miles to Atlanta School. Democrat in spring and fall, when there was enough snow on the ground, Mr. Knudsen used his caboose on runners with a little wood-burning heater inside the wooden enclosure, the sliding window for the reins to the horses, and the little window at the back. It had a sort of shelf on each side for us to sit on. I saw this as the last word in luxury for wintertime travel, and it was cozy.
And what do you call it?
Caboose. I've heard the driver had to be extra careful not to attempt sharp turns with the caboose. Having only 2 runners, it was easy to tip over. It must have taken us 1.5 hours to get to Atlanta School, with a 3/4 hour walk to 2.5 miles of bush, then another 3/4 hour for the 5 mile ride with the horses at an occasional trot. I would need to leave home no later than 7:30 in the morning. I do remember one winter morning coming out of the bush to the road and the place where I was supposed to meet our ride. The caboose had just left, and I could see it receding down the road, 1/4 or less of mile away. I was tired from the walk, but decided to run after it in an attempt to catch up, or at least be seen by the other older kids in the caboose. I ran and ran, swinging my noon lunch in my lard pail for 1/4 mile to across from Gunderson's yard. As the horses were at a trot, and I out of breath, I could see the distance between me and the caboose was widening, so I gave up. Apparently no one looked out the caboose little back window to see me on the road behind them. Otherwise they would have waited. I was very deeply discouraged because I enjoyed school and had to come home that morning after a 6-mile round trip of walking and running in the snow. We never did figure out if I was late that morning or Mr. Knudsen left early because the other pupils at our end were there. I suspect the latter was true, because next day, Saturday, Dad, taking along our clock, timed our walk and compared clock times at Gunderson's, concluded that I had been on time. Anyway, that's as far as that went. My 3rd year of school, in grade 3, 1945, with the jubilation the Second World War had ended, Hallcroft School reopened. Also, my younger brother Mike started school. In 1946, there finally was room in the new Pine Creek log schoolhouse for brother Mike and me. This was the school district we belonged in. And I started grade 4 at 10 years of age. Miss Violet Scott was our teacher. The log building was cozy. And in the wintertime, probably warmer than the new frame building on the full basement that for its life as a schoolhouse had water from seepage on its dirt floor. The new building opened for classes in 1947. The log schoolhouse was across the road from the John Warken farm yard and a quarter mile from the new Pine Creek store, operated by Mrs. Annie Nalesnik. Also, the new Pine Creek dance hall on Warken's quarter was between their yard and the store. In the same area was a neat little log building that served as a teacherage. It also occasionally served as a place for a little romance and courtship between the teachers and the young men and women who had finished school. For me, my brother Mike, and later my five sisters, Victoria, Evangeline, Irene, Nellie, and Caroline, the walk to the new school was 2.5 miles across country, over little fields and through bush. This was a half mile closer than the original New Pine Creek log school. My youngest brother, Steve, and youngest two sisters, Joyce and Kathy, rode the school bus when they started school. By the way, there are 10 of us, 3 brothers and 7 sisters. Two brothers, seven sisters.
Plus you, so 10 altogether.
That's correct. In the spring of 1952, I finished grade 10 at New Pine Creek School. The last 3 years were by correspondence courses. The last year was under the supervision of Miss Olia Kowalczyk, who later married Peter Marchuk in the district. I turned 17 years of age that spring and went to work as a grease monkey and errand boy at Nick Mandrushek's garage in Boyle, Alberta. I earned $60 a month for 5 days per week of work. Out of that $60, I spent $40 a month for room and board. I will now go back to my boyhood on the farm with the chores and responsibilities when not in school. Up to about 7 years of age, when Mom had to be in the fields working with Dad, I would be left in the house to play with and watch over my younger siblings. Early on, I learned to peel potatoes, build a fire in a wood stove, and with the right amount of salt, I'd boil the potatoes in preparation for Mom and Dad when they came in for dinner. Mom would add meat and other stuff from the garden for the meal. I also would sometimes have to change diapers on my baby sisters, a job I hated. The diapers were made from used flour and sugar bags, were washed, dried, and used over and over. Mother really had mountains of house and garden work to do when she didn't have to help Dad. I'd help a little with the smaller jobs, gather eggs, bring in firewood, weed the garden, and so forth. These were summers, and I had lots of time to play outside with my brother and little sisters. Sometimes a neighbor boy would come over to play. After 7 years of age, during summer holidays and after school, I worked with my father, and sometimes alone, on jobs requiring axe or hammer work. A lot of the work involved clearing the land of forest for cultivation. So I'm talking about clearing the land. In the histories of early settlement, in the county of Athabasca, it is often correctly stated the settlers had to clear the land for cultivation. My objective is to illustrate in detail the work involved that cannot be expressed by one sentence, paragraph, or page. In advance, I wish to apologize to and warn the listener, unless you are genuinely interested in the detailed method and tools employed by my parents, their children, and other families, you will find these, my memories, extremely boring. The first year I remember helping to clear was 6 acres, and 2 years later was a strip of 8 acres. There were 35 acres cleared before I can remember and under cultivation. The reason I will go into detail about land clearing in the early years is it might have some historical value, and the work will surely never be done that way again. To start with, the tools we used were a two-man muscle powered crosscut saw, axes, a mattock, which everyone called a grub hole, a gaff, which was a steel hook bolted to the end of about a 16-foot long light pole. We also needed files and sharpening stone. On trees 3 inches and more in diameter, we would use the grub hoe to hoe the dirt and rocks away off the roots and between them. We had to be very careful not to dull our axes by striking a rock or stone. Dad always chopped the tree roots a good distance away from the tree trunk, and had brother Mike and I do the same. The larger the tree, the farther away the roots were chopped. He explained the reason for this was that the breaking plow would turn over the furrow neater in thinner roots, which were farther from the tree's base. Also, when it came to root picking time, we would have slightly smaller roots to physically pull out of the furrows. To begin with, we children would chop down only the small saplings, the small brush, dragging and throwing them up on the brush piles that were built on top of the large trees that Dad felled. We'd also pile the limbs and tops of adjoining trees that Dad felled. The brush pile was always built in the patch where the thickest and tallest trees were. The trees were mostly aspen with the occasional black poplar, willow clump, and white spruce. After all the roots were cut, the tree could usually be pushed over by hand. The larger trees grew to 16 inches across at the base and to 70 feet high. These aspen would have up to 85 years of growth rings. The big trees took a lot of grub hoe work to get at all the deep roots. On a tree that refused to fall, it took a few tries at pushing or pulling it, then digging for more roots to cut. The ones with some natural lean to them were easier to fall. On the large trees with no lean, Dad would use the gaff, the steel hook bolted to about a 16-foot long pole. First, as on all felling of the larger trees, everyone was alerted to get the hell out of the way. Next, the faller looked around for a safe place for himself to run. He'd take the gaff and hook it on an overhead branch as high as handy, and get the tree swaying by pulling and relaxing on the pole. When the tree started to fall towards him, the faller would simply unhook the gaff and, taking it with him, step out of the way. After the tree was felled, the clay stuck to the middle of the stump below the tree's base, and to its roots had to be scraped and knocked off for a complete burn of the stump. Also with the grub hoe, the hole where the tree had been was filled and leveled. Next, the two-man crosscut saw was used to cut off the tree stump and cut the tree up into two or three lengths, depending on the tree's length. The limbs were axed off the tree and dragged to the brush pile, which burned best when built high. The logs of the tree were later dragged by a horse and chain to a brush pile, or if it was time to start a new brush pile, the logs were rolled together for the base of a new brush pile. The horse would also drag the stump to the pile. Sure, a lot of detail. If the felled tree was to be the start of a new brush pile, the stump was not cut off. After falling, cutting off the stumps, limbing, and topping a lot of the trees, usually full length, were loaded on the wagon and hauled into a full year's supply pile for stove wood near the house. Those hot summer days, we drank a lot of water, which we carried to the bush from our well in 2-quart glass canning jars wrapped in small water-soaked burlap sacks and kept in the shade. Oh, how good that fresh cold water was from the hand-dug well that still had winter's ice in it. You know, in spite of the hard work clearing land that way, I kind of enjoyed it. As a kid, I was getting real handy with an axe and growing stronger. We were always surrounded by the fragrances of the different kinds of cut wood and their crushed leaves.
Can I ask you how old you were?
No older than 7. No older than 7.
Okay.
No. Started that easily at 6. That kind of worked. And then after starting school, during the summer holidays, we had all these days. And after schools, weekends, Dad, Mike, and I each had our own axes. Dad, he always used the newest at once, both single and double-edged. Mike and I both used old double-edged and sometimes the spare old single-edged axe. The old axes, being worn down to the thicker steel, took more work to file back and sharpen. We wore out many files, chopping roots in our stony ground. It becomes more difficult to chop deep, which we always strove for with every swing, because of the resistance to penetration of a thick edge. So, of course, when the axe got older, the edge got worn back to where it was thicker. Dad bought a 2-inch thick by about 12-inch diameter whetstone with its hardware. He built a 4-legged stand with a water trough for the stone, the bottom of which was always in the water. The whetstone had a shaft through it. Each end of the shaft rested on 2 little wheels, which acted as bearings and were bolted to the sides of the stand. Also, on one end of the shaft was a crank, man killer. After filing the nicks and so forth out of the axe blades, Dad would sit at one end of the whetstone stand and press the cutting edge of the axe against the stone while Mike or I cranked it. I always counted, when I was cranking, the revolutions of the stone to around 200. Then Mike would take his turn, also counting. It took a long time to do 3 double-edged axes to Dad's satisfaction. Of course, he was just sitting, he didn't have to crank. There was a blacksmith in Elscott in the late 1940s who had a good reputation for building up plowshares and old axes. As he did it for much less money than it took to buy a new axe, one winter Dad took 3 of our old axes for him to build up. Another bonus was that that blacksmith had a good supply of moonshine. Those built-up axes turned out real good, considerably heavier, a wider edge, and good taper to the edge. For Mike and me, it was only one blow to cut off a tree limb, where before it took 3 blows. Dad kept using new axes. Eventually, we wore out the built-up axes too, while clearing land, and in the wintertime, cutting logs for lumber. When limbing with an axe, use lots of force and aim at the base against the log. This leaves neat job, makes the log easier to roll, and prevents injury by a rolling log or a rolling log's branch stubs snagging on clothing. When I look at the axes sold in the hardware stores, during as much as the past 50 years, I see that they have lost their style from what they used to be. They look, to me, look more like malls to see the axes in hardware stores nowadays. It is obvious people's dependence on the axe for a part of their living ended about 60 years ago. The axes of the 1930s and 40s, I remember, were really streamlined with wider and more tapered cutting edges. The best axes for good steel and balance were made in Sweden. They were actually beautiful, those axes of long wood. Nowadays, but then people don't need them like we used to. We would come home for our dinner around 1 p.m. Mom would have this ready for Dad and Mike and me and our sisters at home. Boy, could we eat lots. After dinner, Dad would lie down for an hour's nap in the heat of the day. Mike and I would go to the cool log granary where our beds were through the summer and do the same. After the naps, we would go back to work till around 8 p.m. and supper. I remember feeling renewed energy in the evenings when the sun receded. Those days, Mom would search for the cows, bringing them home and milk them herself. When I was 9 years old, I decided to do a memory experiment. I believe this little story is unique. It was a sunny summer day at around 1 o'clock. I'd just come home from grubbing out trees and building another brush pile by way of land clearing. I don't remember where Dad and the brother Mike were that afternoon, just that I'd worked alone. Before going in for dinner, I stopped at the well and pulled a pail of cold water out of the well and sat down on the end of the water trough, taking the occasional drink. I was feeling very satisfied with myself and in a reflective mood. I'd look at the sun, which was shining through high cloud, and down at my ragged work overalls. You know, I do really see this. I'm not making this up. I was trying to remember some couple of years or more back how happy my family and I were when our relatives came to visit all the way from Edmonton. The happiness I remembered, their dressy clothes, nice car, but a lot of details I couldn't recall, to my disappointment. Then I told myself, I'm going to try to remember this day and what I am thinking. I am 9 years old. I wish I'd tried this when I was younger. And you know, I really did feel grown up. Then after another sip of water, glance at my ragged overalls, I emphasized, remember, this is a nice day, and I am 9 years old, sitting on the end of this horse trough next to the well. I am old enough now that I can do as much work as my father. Remember this interlude. Through the decades, I've rehearsed that trivial scene, and 71 years later, I do remember. Around 1946, the first bulldozer appeared in our district, knocking down and piling trees. That was a sight to behold. To cut down on the expense of hiring the machine and the operators, Dad had them knock down and pile only the larger trees. The smaller ones were just knocked down and trampled, so we still had axe work to do to clean this up. What an improvement! We could clear so many more acres in less time and effort. I couldn't get enough of watching in amazement as the bulldozer pushed those big trees over, though it did have some trouble with a large spruce. That was the year we retired the gaff hook and its long pole mentioned earlier in this story. In subsequent years, I sometimes wondered what became of that hook. 55 years later, I had to cut down a big old bam that was leaning toward the electric wires on the farmyard. As I was cutting the limbs off the bam, I came to a thick one, and there was the old gaff hook, mostly overgrown by the wood, where it had been hung many years ago. Its pole had rotted off. As our land was very stony, after the trees were cleared off, we had to dig out and haul away the exposed rocks. This was even before the initial plowing. For this, we used spades, crowbars, chain, four-horse team, stone boat, and lots of human muscle. There were about four boulders on that quarter section that were roughly 6 feet long by 2.5 deep. To remove these, we dug a trench around them to their full depth. Then we filled the trench all around with firewood and piled logs on top. During the burn of all this wood and its coals, Dad would bring a couple of 45-gallon drums full of water on the stone boat with our team of horses. When the fire was done, the boulder was very hot, and Dad would throw pailfuls of water on it. That boulder cracking sounded like rifle shots, and there was clouds of steam. The boulder would crack in various directions, leaving us with manageable chunks. The next half day would be spent hauling the pieces off the clearing on the stone boat and filling the hole where the boulder was. Mum, Dad, I, and my brother, my sisters, and later my wife and our two children have been picking rocks out of 100 acres on that quarter after every cultivation since the first homesteaded. Never seemed to, well, it's pretty clean now. Cultivation averaged one in 5 years. The initial plowing of the virgin land with its shallow 2-inch topsoil and tree roots was always referred to as breaking the land. There was always someone within 6 miles of our place that had a tractor and breaking plow. For traction, those tractors had V-shaped steel lugs bolted around their steel rear wheels. The lugs were about 4.5 inches high and to me looked like the shiny teeth of some monster. The tractor would run over a covered rock once in a while, and the operator could feel the lug's contact with the rock. The odd time I was allowed to ride with the driver coming home off the field, when the hind wheel ran over a rock, I could feel all the iron in that tractor shudder. Those machines were built heavy and tough. One time I remember Walter Nalesnik doing the braking for us. The tractor engine got too hot. Without thinking, he quickly loosened the radiator cap to see if there was enough water in the rod. He scalded his face, hand, and arm by the escaping under pressure boiling water. He took only about a day and a half off work, probably using some home remedy on the burns. About 6 years later, Dad hired the Huffs to do some braking for us. As Norman Huff was cranking to start the engine, that backfired. Through the naturally stiff arm, it pulled his forehead down hard on top of the iron radiator shroud. Did that fracture his skull? Who knows? Nobody bothered the doctor then. The iron was undamaged, and his father took over the braking for a couple of days while Norman rested his headache. The braking plows cut a furrow in the soil. Tree roots and rocks about 12 inches wide to whatever depth was set by a lever on the plow, usually 5 inches. It had one plowshare and moldboard. It also had a coulter, which was a thick, about 5 inch wide, vertical shear. The bottom end of the coulter had a socket that fit over a long point on the front of the plowshare. The top of the coulter was firmly bolted to the frame of the plow. The coulter's job was to cut a vertical slit through the soil, roots and so forth, for the shear and moldboard to turn the 12-inch slice of furrow over. There was always a spare shear and coulter. After getting dull, they had to be sharpened, which was often in rocky land. During the braking, my brothers, and my job was to follow the braking plow with spades and to dig out most exposed and some loosened rocks, then throw them out on top of the plowed land to be gathered later onto the stone boat. Mike had to look after one side of the field and me the other. Dad would do a short part of Mike's side with a crowbar. Dad always wore leather gloves, but we children worked barehanded till we left home. Some stones took time to dig out, so we had to hurry on every round of the tractor and plow to get them out of the trench before the tractor was back on our side of the field. It was about 1950, and me 14 years old, and brother Mike 12, that Dad hired Bill McKay to do some braking. Mr. McKay from the Hallcroft School District had one of his twin boys, Bobby, who was a year older than me, walk behind his braking plow. This was so that Bobby could help unplug the tangle of tree roots in front of the plow's coulter, which happened every once in a while. Every once in a while this would happen, forcing the plow out of the ground. Bobby would meet with Mike and me on opposite sides of the field with every round of the tractor. For amusement, Bobby, who knew no Ukrainian, would ask me to say something shorthand Ukrainian that he could tell Mike on the other side of the field to impress Mike with his knowledge of Ukrainian. For instance, Bob would ask me, how do you say, you work hard? I'd tell him, and he'd repeat the Ukrainian over and over to himself till he walked over to Mike's side and told Mike. Then there was much hilarity between us, because what I told Bob and he told Mike was, you're as dumb as a stump. Instead of, you work hard, Mike would return the favor with a message from me. Most of the language we used is not worth repeating here, as all of us boys found indecent words much more interesting and easier to learn in another language. We wouldn't dare let our parents know what we were saying back and forth and learning. Now, as I write these memories, it doesn't seem nearly as entertaining and funny as it did then.
That's not true.
After the breaking was done, I should add to that, to telling people didn't understand Ukrainian how to say some of it. Some of the things we told the guys were terrible. Like, if they were to have dinner someplace and they wanted somebody in the Ukrainian place and they wanted to thank mother for the dinner, they would ask us how to say thank you, and we'd tell them something like, well, you say in Ukrainian, it meant, well, you kiss my ass. Sometimes we were kind of bad.
And then they said that to your mom?
I don't think we went quite that far, no.
Oh, okay.
Because we cared about mom enough, they don't want to hurt her feelings.
No.
After the breaking was done, it was time to pick roots. 1948 and on, I do not remember Dad picking roots with 10-year-old brother Mike and I, 12 years old. It was all up to us. That summer we did 21 acres. Picking roots involved more effort than the word picking suggests. The tree roots were not always laying loose on the soil, and often we would need to pull with all our might to get them out of the furrows soil. Some were short and some real long with many branches. Mike and I both had our axes, and the roots that went down deeper than the plow cut, we had to chop off. For a proper burn, we always beat the roots against each other to knock the dirt off. We'd make little piles of them. Then when we had an armload, we carried the little piles to a large pile. As always, we worked without gloves. And I remember our calloused hands becoming very dry under the dirt. It was a treat to moisten them with our drinking water. The brush piles were burned the first autumn, the land broken, the next summer roots picked and root piles burned. After about another week of rock picking with Dad, brother and sisters, four horses and stone boat, the 21 acres were ready to seed for the first time next spring. One day, while burning root piles, I threw a remaining thick root into the hot coals. Without me knowing, till I smelled cloth burning, a glowing cinder flew up and burned a hole through the bib of my overalls. I remember being embarrassed at having to wear those overalls with a hole burned through to school. In the New Pine Creek history book, there is a 1946 photo of New Pine Creek schoolboys and me wearing those overalls. That photo helped keep memories of the event alive. One more memory about burning root piles. When the piles were burned right down to just glowing coals, we'd go to the house and get some potatoes, probably fresh from Mom's garden. Without washing or wrapping them, we'd bury them in the ashes and coals. After leaving the potatoes there till they were cooked right through, the black skin came off easily in our grubby hands. With a sprinkle of salt, we ate them, flavored by the coals of those raw tree roots. I know I've never, in the last 70 years since, eaten a potato that tasted better. They were good. The crops on new broken land always better yielding than those on land that had been cultivated a few years. The second year's crop on virgin land that was plowed the second time were the best yielding. This second plowing was called back setting. I speak of the time before we used any chemical fertilizers or sprays, talking about the crop yields or comparing them. Dad continued farming with his four horses, Mom and us children. Last four words meant to be humorous. Dad continued farming with his four horses, Mom and us children, till February of 1951. It was then that he bought a brand new John Deere Model AR tractor and a new three-bottom hydraulic lift plow and a new 10-foot disc. So a new tractor, new plow, new disc, all for $2,450. That spring, 1951, I turned 15 years of age. Till then, I'd had no experience or contact with any kind of engine, not even the smallest. Dad, a man we children feared, made me learn to operate the tractor, keep track of the oil changes, and make sure I never missed any grease nipples during the daily greasing. He himself never did try to operate the tractor and couldn't be bothered with any of its maintenance. I have never been able to understand his attitude towards not driving the tractor and his mistreatment of Mom and us children. One thing it did do is made me worry a lot and feel responsible for the welfare of Mom and my nine younger siblings, till they all left home. That is another long, painful story that I do not wish to repeat. That spring, Dad was very angry, it seemed, every day. Instead of being happy to operate the new equipment, I remember feeling burdened and very depressed that spring, trying to do my school studies and studying the tractor manual over and over, with its unfamiliar words. It was up to me to tell him the quantities and viscosities of oils to buy for adding to the engine and the different oil changes. These things and the tractor and plow operation I had to learn in less than 3 months when spring plowing would start. Through my years in school in the springtime, we practiced sports events. The highlight was when pupils from surrounding schools gathered in Colinton for the track meet. At the track meet, we competed with the best in each school for first, second, and third prize ribbons. I enjoyed those days because I got to see town and buy a little ice cream and pop. I also did well competing. I will remember the spring of 51, looking up from my work on the tractor. I saw the bus with my schoolmates go by to the track meet without me, because I, 15 years old, had to plow. After that, I did the land cultivation with the tractor. Dad did the seeding, harrowing, hay cutting, and harvesting with the binder, while Mom, Mike, and I stooped the grain sheaves. In a couple of years, that machinery, except the hay mower, were changed over and pulled by the tractor, with Brother Mike or me operating. In 1952, Dad bought a brand new 1-ton Fargo truck. This, like with the tractor, he never attempted to drive. So I, and a couple of years later, Brother Mike, became his drivers. We had 6 miles of dirt road, no gravel, to the baseline, which was graveled, and another 7 miles to Colinton. That dirt road was full of deep ruts, often with water laying in them. The ruts were made by the occasional vehicle from our neighborhood. The grader came by maybe 2 times through the spring, summer, and fall. That is for all 3 seasons, 2 times. We were sort of on the frontier back there in New Pine Creek. That 1-ton truck, as even the modern ones, 1-tons, had very little traction on the muddy dirt. When we had the load of grain to haul to Colinton Elevator, the extra weight provided good traction. When we had to go in for groceries, mail, or gasoline, it was different. For gasoline, I'd load 3 empty 45-gallon drums and a half ton of rocks at the back end of the truck box for traction. We put the truck in low and second gear and ground away in the ruts for 6 miles. This was when it rained. The truck would have to jerk from side to side, as the ruts were never straight. With the new truck, we could even go to Athabasca on business. This was 8 miles farther than Colinton and had more businesses. I left school in 1953, turning 18 years of age. I left home that summer to find work that paid wages. After all, I needed to buy a car to chase the girls with, cigarettes, dance, movie tickets, hey, and very importantly, to buy leather gloves to pick rocks in. Brother Mike was left at home to take my place with running the farm equipment. Boy, was I glad to be free. Dad's health was getting bad, and there were 7 younger than Mike siblings at home with Mom. After 2 years, I came back home to do the farm work, so that Mike could be free to go to work for wages for 2 years. After that, besides both being away working on the drilling rigs through the winters, Mike and I changed off to do the summer farm work. In the fall of 1968, I bought that old half section with 12-year-old modern farmhouse, no plumbing, and some farm machinery for $10,000. Mike, with hired carpenters, provided the labor, and my parents and I the funding to build a nice retirement home in Athabasca for Mom and Dad. After buying the farm at 32 years of age, I also bought a D6 Caterpillar bulldozer, Then I bought a large Nordheimer 2 24-inch bottom breaking plow. With this unit, I was able to bury trees up to 9 foot tall that we had to once axe away as kids. That plow certainly rolled out a lot of rocks. When cleaning up the last half mile of mineral soil of our half-section farm, I had 7 large pits dug to bury the rocks that were picked off the fields and hauled into that fence line. The rocks in the north half mile of fence went into the roadbed when New Pine Creek Road was being built. The south quarter mile of fence is still full of rock hauled off the field. There are also 2 large piles on pasture off that field. Another pile at the southwest end of the home quarter. A quarter mile row of rock pushed into Camelchuk's bush when Dave and I were rebuilding that west stretch of fence. There's the equivalent of a large pile of rocks over a creek bank on the west side of the quarter. Finally, there is a solid quarter mile row running north to south along the fence for cattle access to pasture from the farmyard. This solid row of quarter mile of rock runs down the center of the home quarter. As you, dear listener, have probably concluded, I know that the east half section of Section 32, Township 63, Range 21, west of the 4th, should never, never have been farmed. When I bought it, I certainly knew the place well, with its forest, rocks, and over 100 acres of tamarack swamp, with swamp spruce and willow, the deep peatland, where as a boy I remember going to different neighbors, asking them to come to help us pull a cow stuck in the muck out of it. That 100-plus acres of bog with its trees I cleared after getting stuck with my bulldozer many times. I also had it ditched, cultivated, and seeded, and it was not all in vain. It now produces cattle pasture with no chemical fertilizer and the volume that none of the mineral soil can come close to. When I started the work on the home place on my own at 32 years of age, I was often asked, "Why do you want to do all that work?" My honest answer always was, "Well, I can't build an Eiffel Tower or do anything famous, so instead I will leave a tiny permanent scratch on this landscape that will benefit me and future generations." I think some of the questioners understood my answer. Also, I did need the challenge to make something neat and productive out of adversity and disorder. The job would only have been a simple drop in the lake for someone with lots of money, but that money I didn't have. Growing up, I heard so many stories of the Great Depression and its foreclosures that I refused to take on debt and borrow money. I think that those stories still got me, my mind poisoned, because I'm awful tight with my money. After I left home in 1953 till 1972, when I got married at 36 years of age, I worked at various jobs as a bricklayer's helper in Calgary, then north of Fort St. John on a seismic crew as a cat skinner and grader and snowplow operator, out of mile 101 on the Alaska Highway. Mostly I worked on the deep hole drilling rigs in northeastern BC and in many Alberta oil fields. I always chose jobs that involved living in camps, which made it easier to save money. I skidded logs with my own cat and winch out of a camp in the Mariana Lake country west of the Fort McMurray Highway. The last 10 years, I hauled water to the drilling rigs. At one time, I owned one brand new single axle tank truck on which I trained new Pine Creek neighbor Peter Choney to operate, and a second one that I'd bought new 2 years earlier and continued to operate myself. A year later, I sold the newer unit with job to Peter. Sometimes when speaking with my older friends in the drilling rig camps, they would tell me about their children. There were at least two, Bill Simpson and Swede Christensen, who had worked their way up through the ranks to supervisory positions with very high pay. They told me their children had finished school and were leaving home. With sad regret, they would say, the years have flown by, and because of so much time living in these camps, I never got to know my own kids. I think those words had a lot to do with my decision to buy the Rocky Hole farm and make a small cattle farm out of it, so that in making a living for us, I could be at home with our children. I have a list of three reasons. My reasons for going farming, besides wanting the challenge mentioned earlier, were as follows. First reason was, though it was 4 years before I married, I didn't perceive that as a problem. I wanted our children to grow up with both their parents always at home, where we could engage in communication and dialogue at any time. Also, thought it important that sometimes we could work together and be away from what I considered negative influences on children in a town setting. Second reason, I wanted my scattered siblings from west to east of Canada and down to Florida to be able to come back home, which they did once in a while. And the third reason, I didn't want the effort of my parents and brothers and sisters put into that land to be abandoned with its memories. Now on to a different subject, more or less. I met my wife, Dorothy, through mutual friends when she worked in Vancouver. We were married in May of 1972 in Ottawa, where she was raised. I mentioned her only briefly, as she is writing her own story. Also, I'd written our story in both the Colleton and District's Yesterday and Today book and the book Sharing the Past, New Pine Creek District. My sister, Irene De La Porta, also contributed to the New Pine Creek book. Starting in 1972, Dorothy, my wife, and I farmed, wintering an average of 50 pregnant cows. About the first 3 years, I took on the occasional water hauling job, and besides the home section, I rented an adjoining quarter section from Eric Doring. I also leased a government quarter section for grazing. I grew mostly hay and oats and a little barley, even some wheat, oh, 1 year of canola. I hayed different neighbors' fields on a crop share basis. For extra income, I did various jobs in the neighborhood with my cat and dozer. Also some custom work with my combine and swather and a little trucking. I did my own repairs on the machinery, including welding, which I learned after buying the farm. With my welding, I invented an automatic tractor to implement hitch, a farm program on TV about on-farm inventions called Prairie Farm Report, featured me with my hitch in the 1990-1991 season. From a neighbor, I understand that segment was played even a few years later. I never watched the show that often. Dear reader or listener, from the previous long pages of this story, I don't blame you for thinking my life was all work. Not so. Growing up, I did have time to play with my siblings and neighbor kids. After leaving home and going to work in the oil fields, I had many nights and weeks during rig shutdowns on the town. With the transient nature of work on the drilling rigs, I did have romantic escapades with the fair sex in the different towns, sort of like the reputation sailors have. Forgive me, my future wife and children. I couldn't live like a monk for 36 years. Before my marriage, I'd traveled all over Alberta and through a good part of BC and north to Watson Lake and the Yukon. Many holidays in the mountains, including once taking my parents, who had never seen the mountains. In 1967, at 29 to 30 years of age, I went on two separate guided tours by coach to somewhere around 13 different European countries and their capital cities, including Moscow. I celebrated my 30th birthday at the Moulin Rouge in Paris, France. Prior to the tours, flew to London, and after the tours, sailed from England to Montreal. As part of the tours, sailed across the English Channel four times. Same autumn, on the way home, I visited the Montreal Exposition. Then bought a new car in Toronto, and with Brother Mike and Evelyn, whom he met in Europe, we drove back to Alberta. Further to my life, not being all work, after my marriage and settling down on the farm, Laura, our daughter, was born in December 1974, and son, Roland, in May 1976. Looking back, my marriage to Dorothy and the births of Laura and Roland were the most special parts of my life. Before, and as the children were growing up, we made it a point to take trips to the mountains for a week to 10 days before the start of the farm's haying season. We drove to Prince George, to Brother Steve's, and Vancouver, Sister Nell's, plus visits with friends in Vancouver, on the Vancouver Island. I made trips to Calgary to visit Sisters Victoria and Evangeline and their husbands. Again with the children, we flew to Ottawa a few times to visit Dorothy's parents, Jack and Florence Stotesbury, and Shirley and her husband, Harley Cummings. I list these things because I've been reading back through the previous notes, and it seemed like my life was all work, so I have to put in it wasn't. I did have some time to play. I tried to focus on the journey as well as the destination, so the trips we took were loosely planned. We'd stop overnight at the motels when we felt like. With that attitude, Dorothy and our school-aged Laura and Roland drove to visit Sister Caroline in Regina, then down to Minot, North Dakota, on to Rapid City, South Dakota, where Dorothy lost the car keys, causing another day and night stay there. He drove around in the Black Hills and, of course, visited Mount Rushmore National Monument, or memorial, then west through Wyoming, soaking in the Thermopolis Hot Springs Pool, on through the Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Parks, east and north into Montana, visiting the little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. From there north through Great Falls into Alberta and home. Shortly after the children left home, Dorothy and I flew to Phoenix, Arizona for our son Roland's graduation in electronics engineering from a college there, Phoenix. We visited beautiful Sedona while there. Maybe a couple of years later, we flew to San Francisco to visit Roland again for Christmas in Tracy, where he lived when he lived there and worked in the Silicon Valley. Prior to this, we attended his wedding to Kathy in California. I had sold off our little cattle herd shortly after the children left home. Again, we visited Roland and Kathy in Frisco, Texas, after they moved there from Tracy. Frisco was just on the outskirts of Dallas. Dorothy and I flew to Gainesville, Florida, to visit my sister Irene and her husband Joe Della Porta when they lived at Silver Springs. Sweet Irene drove us around sightseeing from Daytona Beach on the Atlantic to Cedar Key in the Gulf of Mexico and many places in between during our stay with her and Joe. In November of 2000, daughter Lara arranged a beautiful wedding to Kevin Mahaden in Varadero, Cuba. We spent a very enjoyable couple of weeks there. Dorothy and I toured around the island, taking in the Havana, then Trinidad on the Caribbean shore. Dorothy and I sold the last of our cattle off in January of 1992, and the farm machinery by auction in June of 1995. We continued to live on our neat little farm, renting out the cultivated land and pasture. I enjoyed the heated shop for warm vehicles in the winter and for its acoustics for my banjo practice and get-togethers with musical friends. Due to my failing health, Dorothy and I moved off the farm in December of 2012. Both of us at 76 years of age, to Pleasant Valley Lodge in Athabasca. The following spring, I sold the farm, the place of my birth, and where our children grew up. We also had a small auction sale for acreage kind of equipment, shop tools, and household odds and ends. I surprised even myself that the transition from the farm to the lodge was not at all difficult. Probably that was due to advanced planning for a few years to meet head-on with an inevitable part of life. Now in the fourth year of our lives at the lodge, both Dorothy and I are very content with our different interests. A big bonus is having Kevin, Lara, and grandchildren, Nick and Jasmine, living nearby, with thanks to medical science and those who practice it, my cup is overflowing. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much.